Good morning and welcome to the roundtable for this Friday, the 11th of December. Very nice to have you with us. We go in with Frank Sinatra this morning as tomorrow marks the 100th birthday. He was born 100 years ago tomorrow in Hoboken, New Jersey, and we will certainly be celebrating the centennial later on in the program, and we'll be hearing Frank all morning. So that's good news, at least for those of us who enjoy Frank, although for some reason Rosemary's scowling, but I think we'll get into that in a few minutes. We'll talk about that later on.
I'm not scowling. No.
You look perturbed. Let me introduce our panel to you. WAMC's Alan Shartok is here. Good morning, sir.
I'm here, but in an undisclosed location.
All right.
So that the guy who looks in and says, "Where is Alan? Did he shrink even more?" would not have to worry.
Yes. So we are very happy that you are with us, because in radio, you're here in our minds, and that doesn't really matter where you are, does it?
Well, yes, it doesn't.
University at Albany journalism professor and investigative reporter Rosemary Armeo, also in an undisclosed location. She's in Alan's seat.
I know. I took over the big chair today, Alan.
And essayist, author, editor, and activist Barbara Smith joins us, and it's a delight to have you here, Barbara, as it is each and every Friday. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
All right. We, of course, welcome your comments, roundtable@wamc.org, roundtable@wamc.org. Yesterday on the show, we attempted to have a Trump-free Thursday.
Didn't work out
too well. And
I'm well aware I was listening.
Yes. And it's not going to work out today either, I must say, because there's two interesting stories. One in the Washington Post this morning about how the GOP is preparing for a contested convention. And this is something, of course, that Alan has talked about many times. Republican officials and leading figures in the party's establishment are preparing for the possibility of a brokered convention as businessman Donald Trump continues to sit atop the polls in the GOP presidential race. More than 20 of them convened Monday near the Capitol for a dinner held by Republican National Committee Chairman, Renice Priebus?
Rance?
I
hear Rance, don't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
R-A-N-C, Rance?
Well, it's pronounced like R-A-N,
okay.
Yeah.
All right,
like
I'll go with
rant
that.
And rave.
And just for the point of just the way it sounds, not meaning anything, Rance is in rancid.
Yes. And the prospect of Trump nearing next year's nominating convention in Cleveland with a significant number of delegates dominated the discussion, according to five people familiar with the meeting. And so they're discussing the scenario. And I guess my question is, number one, is that putting the cart before the horse? We have a long way. Or is it sensible for the party to prepare for such an eventuality?
Well, if I go first, which is always fun, I would say that they know what's going to come. They know, they see the handwriting on the wall. They're also caught, because if Donald Trump decides to run as a Ralph Nader type candidate, a third party candidate, and if I'm him right now, I'm preparing to be on like a working families party or a Trump party in every state in the union that you can possibly be on, right? So that line is there for you up until the very end. And they can look six steps in advance, and they can see what the problem is going to be. So I would have loved to have been the fly on the wall listening to what potential fixes they have, because I don't think they have many. What they're going to have to do is get behind someone. And the idea that they would get behind Ted Cruz, who is now surging in the polls, must be unpleasant to many of them.
And Cruz is the one candidate who seems to have really taken advantage of this possibility long before that. He's worked in 40 states so far.
That's right.
To make sure his name is on the ballot. So his people foresaw this possibility from the very beginning. They're working all the basically technical angles to get on the ballots.
Right.
So that is a scary thing. I also found it notable, because it's usually Jeb Bush who's done that. The Bush machinery knows how to work the system. This has gone very differently from how Republicans had planned this election after the one last time. They wanted a nice, smooth selection process. They wanted a candidate firmed up and on the way to fighting Hillary by March, and that does not appear to be happening.
Well, I think that with Ted Cruz as the person who would rescue the party, that just shows that the party is in incredible disarray, because he is incredibly right-wing.
Right.
And
he's too extreme to...
Yeah, he doesn't really provide a contrast. And for mainstream Republicans, I'm not even sure what that means, but for people who are mainstream Republicans, both Trump and I think Ted Cruz are really problematic. So it's just, it's difficult for them.
The party is not taking steps to ensure their future, I would say.
That's correct, as long as they play to the extreme.
Well, what would you do, Rosemary and Barbara? I mean, they really have no choice. These candidates, you know, the moderate candidate, George Pataki, remember him?
Yeah.
There was a piece in the paper this morning that said, please mention anybody you think would be a good president. He got zero votes. You know, in this poll, zero.
And he wasn't the only one, certainly.
Right, but he gets zero. When you think about that, if you want to win the primary, we've said it a million times, you got to cater to these people who are on the right, who turn out in primaries in very small numbers, but are the ones who turn out.
Well, the Republicans who care about their party seem to be going to great extremes to keep everybody together. Paul Ryan is doing this in the House, going to great measures to include everyone and to make sure that the Tea Party is housed in the old line Republican Party. As you said, Barbara, there's some confusion about what that means anymore. I think it may be time to let them go. They're not the same as Republicans that we used to know. This is not George Bush's party. It's not Ronald Reagan's party.
What about Jacob Javits? Yeah. John Lindsay?
Yeah.
What about those people?
Oh, my God, yes. Mm-hmm. Liberal Republicans. Mm-hmm. Wow, what a concept. So maybe it is time to just let the Tea Party go off on its own.
Well, wait a second. You say it is time to let the Tea Party go off on its own.
The extremists.
But that posits that you have that choice, that you can just let them go off on their own. Look, this is a Republican primary. Anybody can run in it. The Tea Party want to take over the Republican Party and have largely succeeded in many cases. We don't get to say, let them go off on their own. And the Republicans certainly don't get to say it, because then they're not going to be a party anymore. I mean, it's over to them.
You mean the Tea Party has won and has taken over the Republican Party? That's what you think?
In the primary system, yes.
Well, that's what they're meeting now, is talking about the primary system. And I think that they could change the rules so that they get it back.
How do you do that?
Well, I don't know all the technicalities, Alan, but if you can change all the rules, you change who's running, who's voting, when they're voting, how they're voting.
You know, Rosemary, anybody can run. I mean, you can't stop people from running. If they say, I want to start something called the Tea Party, and it's going to be, that's what we have, you know, then they got their own party. But if they say, I'm a Republican, and I believe Republican values are to the right of center, and I'm going to run, how do you stop them? I don't get it. I don't see it.
So then you are saying that the Tea Party has taken over.
Oh, yeah. I've said that right from the beginning here, especially when it comes to the primary system. I mean, it depends. I mean, look, if every and Barbara and I have talked about this before, if every Democrat who had a self-interest in this election were to vote, everybody who ever wanted a 15% raise, everybody who wanted to, you know, to have a fair civil rights action, everybody who wanted any of this, there'd be no question. Democrats would win every office in the United States, or every major office, forever. But people don't vote. And that is the big problem with the Republican Party right now. In the primary, you get a 15% turnout.
One of the things that I find interesting, though, is to Rosemary's point, if you look at progressives and people within the Democratic Party who felt disenfranchised from the Democratic Party, many said, okay, and this is how the Green Party got started.
Right.
And so we're not seeing that with the Republican Party. And we're also seeing that somebody, a socialist independent candidate, is running as a Democrat.
Right. Well, I mean, I was saying that the Republicans are going so out of their way to accommodate them that, of course, they're staying in the party and they are taking it over. But Alan is posing that as that's exactly their plan, yeah, is to take it over. So they're not going to leave, even if Paul Ryan stopped accommodating them, even if Rand did stop accommodating them, they would still be doing this. So that's kind of interesting.
By the way, one of the reasons you can have a brokered convention, which the Times is talking about this morning, which I've been talking about all along, is because they've tried to, Rosemary, to your point, they've tried to put some stop gaps or some stops into, mm-hmm, into all of this. They have said, we're going to, in each congressional district, we can appoint whoever we want as a delegate.
Right.
You know, and, right, and super delegates can be appointed who represent the party.
Exactly.
In this. And so they have tried that, but apparently it's not enough.
Yeah. In fact, that may work to Trump's advantage this time.
So, I know we've discussed this, but isn't losing elections a good way to change the system? I mean, if what is happening and continues and the Republicans lose the election, doesn't there have to be a rethinking? I mean, there was a rethinking this time, and it's not working, but doesn't there have
exactly
to be a rethinking the next time?
Well,
that's exactly my point. They just lost twice and have done rethinking. You know, they can't stop these folks from doing what they want to do, Rosemary.
The Republicans have lost the White House. It's
right.
True. But they're wiping up in the state houses
and the legislatures
and the legislatures,
yes, exactly,
and also the national legislature.
Exactly.
Look at the Senate,
mm-hmm,
and the House.
Yeah.
So they're not really doing all that bad for short term.
Well, let me tell you, they think they're doing bad because the presidency is the big enchilada here. You know, there's always this second term malaise that comes in. And here was Barack Obama, and he was saying, let's do health care. Let's do this. And the American people are very cautious. And they said, oh, no, let's wait. Let's balance our bets here. Let's do this. But in this coming election, the chances of a total wipeout, if they have a Cruz who cannot satisfy the middle, or if they have a Donald Trump who 60% of the American people are saying in polling this morning has a very dangerous idea over there, it could be another Goldwater wipeout.
Well, that would be good from the Democratic point of view, but I'll be interested to see if that happens, because this is really, we're still thinking in old-line conventional politics where the presidency was the big prize and the president carried in everyone else. I don't think the Republicans have been using that model. I think they've worked very hard to build up their congressional districts so that they're almost immune from Democratic unhappiness. I think they're going after state houses, and they're going for legislative plans that stymie anybody from the other party who's in an office that they didn't win.
I think when you say that this was their plan, I don't think so. Their plan is to get the presidency. They want the presidency. I think they're really afraid of with Trump is that he is not a bona fide Republican, and he'll bring his own people in. And that's where, you know, even Eisenhower had to bring Dick Nixon in to satisfy the party.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see that. I mean, I think they desperately want the presidency, and they thought it was within their grasp. That's why all these people are running, because everybody thought, after two terms of a Democrat, that's when the Republicans can really make hay and really win. And by the way, that's true historically when there's an open presidency, that anything goes, and that's why everybody wants to be, thinks they can be president.
Well, I think that was certainly true at the start of their very early start to this political season, but surely they're thinking otherwise now. This is an extremely unusual season where you've got outsiders who have done so well, and they basically shut out the establishment candidates.
To say nothing of how well the country is doing. I mean, you know, when the
country?
Stock market.
Oh, I see.
When the stock market is doing well, and when you got 5% unemployment, or whatever is alleged to be 5% of unemployment, by any comparative standard, then that's going to be a very hard election to win. You got a job, that's number one on everybody's list all the time.
Well, the other thing that's changed is the idea that the second presidency, the second term is you know, you kind of wait it out. Obama, in many respects, has been more activist in a second term. He's been bolder. He's taken actions. He's not had to worry about the political consequences. So that the whole political model is shifting, I think.
Some interesting letters, Joe, whenever you're ready.
We have about a minute.
Okay, so Rich says, how can you say we have a democracy? We do not. The Republicans have gerrymandered congressional and state house offices. Big business owns the White House. America in peril. No matter who wins, we lose. All downhill since the death of JFK. By the way, JFK was no flaming liberal. That's for sure.
No, definitely not.
I just want to make that point. Not only that, but if you take a look at the New York State Assembly, Rich, for a moment, you want a study in gerrymandering? There it is. Okay, Rose Rita says, our friend, wow, Alan's on fire this morning. I love it, love it. Jay Jones says, as both Norm Ornstein and Noam Chomsky have said, the GOP is not a political party. Rather, it is a radical insurgency with no interest in parliamentary politics. It has no interest in governing. It only wants to rule. And Rick says, Alan, if Trump runs, it might not be just a Goldwater wipeout for them, but rather a George McGovern magnitude wipeout. That's what he says. And Charlie says, hey, love the show. It gets me through my school commute. My question today is whether or not Bernie Sanders is still polling strong if he has a chance. Most news outlets seem not to mention him. Thanks. And by the way, Rosemary, I think yesterday you mentioned, somebody mentioned that he was polling number one in New Hampshire.
In New Hampshire, 50-30, yeah.
Yes. So does that mean, but not nationally, of
no,
course.
Not nationally.
Yeah. And
we're gonna let's take a break. Sure. We'll come back. We'll continue our conversation. Alan, Rosemary, Barbara, I'm Joe. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We have Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Barbara Smith making up the group this morning, and we welcome your comments. WAMC.org/roundtable. You can write to us. You can we'll post your comments. It'll be right there on the system, and for all to see. And that's all good stuff. So we welcome you. WAMC.org/roundtable. Let us go to other topics this morning, and then we'll go back to some letters before we take another break. But I want to talk about let's talk about Rahm Emanuel for a second. Again, there is a Washington Post article that says he is in deep, deep trouble. The mayor made an impassioned speech this week in Chicago. He apologized in Chicago on Wednesday. He apologized for his action and took some measure of responsibility. This was 2 weeks after a video was released of a Chicago policeman shooting a black teenager 16 times. Although the shooting took place last year. I'm sorry for the shooting of Laquan McDonald, which happened on my watch, said Rahm Emanuel, and he told the full Chicago City Council in a rare speech. For the next 40 minutes, he delivered a genuine and heartfelt speech, their quotes, about police brutality, city violence that seemed real, said critics and supporters alike who heard it. But the reaction on the street was a very different story. Emanuel cried, crocodile tears, one protester said. The only people who believe it will be his lapdog city council. Another said, according to the Tribune, they carried signs calling on Emanuel and his leadership team to resign, which is something you have said from the very beginning.
Yeah, he has to go. And I was a supporter of him. But this is a man who's built his whole reputation on being in control and mastering the entire process. So how do you not hold him responsible for this? It just looks too strange that he held off all action on this until after he was reelected, and then he fires the police chief. I mean, really, how dare he?
Why dare he? If somebody messes up
I believe the police chief did what Rahm Emanuel wanted him to do.
And you know this how?
Well, the thing is, that's the way it works. The police chief serves at the pleasure of the mayor.
Yeah, so does the Secretary of State. So does that anybody else. But when they mess up, it makes sense to make an apology and to fire the guy who runs that organization.
No, I think it's been clear that it was Rahm Emanuel who made the decision to not release the tape
He fought it in court.
Yes.
He did not want it released. Then when the Justice Department moves in, he goes, no, that's misguided. We don't need that here. And now, because he's in a lot of trouble, now he's changed his tune. This is very cowardly.
You know, there was a guy I used to teach with at Rutgers when I first started out. and he had several rules of life. And one of his rules was never apologize, because the people you're apologizing to will take it as a sign of weakness. And if you take a look at the T word, at Donald, he never apologizes. He doesn't apologize.
Rahm Emanuel did apologize. He just wants to hold on to the
what
office.
What I just said is it doesn't make sense to apologize, because when you apologize and you're a politician, it opens up the water. There's blood in the waters. The sharks come after you, and that's the whole point.
But isn't that – I think the sharks were already after him, though. Isn't he apologizing to keep his job? Because if he doesn't apologize, either way, I mean, it seems if he – if he survives the next month, it's going to be surprising.
My argument is that if he apologizes, he's in worse shape in terms of keeping his job than if he doesn't apologize. I think a better explanation, Joe and panel, is that he's afraid of the coming federal investigation and therefore wants to be on the sort of right side of things.
I don't see him having a future as the mayor of Chicago, and I think we should remember what this is about. Sharks coming after you when you cover up the egregious extrajudicial killing, now defined as a homicide, a murder, in the courts, when you cover that up for 13 months, it's ridiculous. I mean, who cares about whether he has a ongoing political career, whether he wants to cover up in relationship to the feds? Right is right, wrong is wrong. If his police chief if he fired his police chief, with whom he consulted and collaborated about, how are we going to handle this? How are we going to handle this? I can hear it. I mean, I can imagine the discussion. Then he needs to exit as well.
The mayor supported him till the moment he threw him out of office. And he did that just as a sacrifice to keep people away from him. And he should not be rewarded for this, for whatever, if his actions are politically astute or not. He should not be rewarded for them.
Right, indeed.
I also want to make note that making matters worse was the fact that at the beginning of all this, Emanuel suggested the shooting was the act of a single bad apple, not,
right,
as the Washington Post editorial board noted, the act of a police department that fatally shoots more people than any other in the nation. An update in the Washington Post database of fatal police shooting: Chicago has 6 fatalities this year, which is behind Los Angeles.
Another... Yes. The Sterling Department, historically. I'm not talking about where they are now. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, these big city police departments generally have incredibly negative relationships to the to people of color, the people who are over-policed,
right,
you know, the communities and neighborhoods that are over-policed, where there is a much more likelihood of crime connected, I would say, directly to poverty.
Right.
And the thing is that this is just the latest chapter.
And there's one other aspect to that, mm-hmm, which is that cities like Chicago and Los Angeles, the white majorities appreciate and look for tough cops. You have to be tough. That makes me feel protected. So I think there's a culture that has allowed this to grow, too, not just politics, but societal.
The accusations also that come out that not only was there great interest in keeping this police footage available to the public,
mm-hmm,
but also that the police destroyed evidence by,
right,
deleting footage of the shooting from a security camera in a nearby Burger King. They had it on tape. They seized it, and then it was destroyed.
Right.
So,
I mean, there's just terribly wrongdoing. So don't get me wrong. I think the police chief should have gone, but not instead of the mayor.
You know, I think Barbara had it right. You have and I've said this before, you have a deprivation of any kind of fair equity in the society that we have kept people of color from the very beginning, right? I mean, there's no question about it. And so are we surprised when we see huge crime numbers in that community, huge numbers of people in prison as a result of it? If somebody takes a gun and walks into a grocery store, I've often said it, they are going to be doing more prison time than the white-collar criminals who may have wiped out people's savings forever. And so we have this dual system, you know, of justice. But if a guy takes a gun and is walking along and it is as a result of the kind of thing that I've just talked about, don't you think that it stands to reason that a cop is going to say – and I'm not talking about this specific case, a cop is going to say, I'm going to shoot to save my life. In New York City, 31,000 cops. Think about that. I think that's what it was when I worked with that department. 31,000 cops. That's a hell of a society and a lobbying group. And believe me, they do it.
Rosemary?
I have nothing to add.
Barbara? No?
Not anything. No.
All right. Let us go on. And then there is, I just want to add to, if I can bring it up here, which they keep on wanting me to subscribe, and I already am. Anyway, the Cook County officer on the scene of the shooting, but there were no reports filed either.
Yeah,
which is another issue.
A whole other issue. That the cop who is indicted now was not the only officer who stood there and saw that summary execution. I agree, that's what it was. So how come we haven't heard from any of them? Why aren't there charges against them? And there were Cook County Sheriff's Department's officials there too. So there, I don't think they're even done in that system. The prosecutor in Chicago, I think, is also culpable and should go. Why hasn't she charged any of them?
And that's why the movement is called Black Lives Matter, because there is less valuing, there is devaluing of the very physical lives of people of color. That's what's driven, that's the bottom line of our system of white supremacy in this country, that you just don't value those other people as highly, and then you can justify acts that in any other situation would be considered to be criminal.
Protecting a fellow officer became more important than shooting down in the middle of the street a teenager.
Who was walking away from the police.
Yes.
He was walking away from them.
Right. Who is not a danger. I mean, he needed help.
Let us take a break. We'll come back. We will get some letters, and we'll finish up with a story or two. And we welcome you to write to us. It's WAMC.org/roundtable, WAMC.org/roundtable. You will see the posting for the question of the day, and just post your comment there, and then we can read it, and then all can see it as well. WAMC.org/roundtable. We'll be right back after this.
Support for WAMT comes from Beacon Fine Art Printing, Beacon, offering museum-quality G-Clay printing, scanning, retouching, and mounting for galleries, artists, photographers, and collectors. BeaconFineArtPrinting.com. Steve Lewis Subaru, Hadley, Massachusetts, a new and used Subaru dealer serving the Pioneer Valley, Hartford, and Springfield, offering new Subarus plus used cars, trucks, and SUVs. SteveLewisSubaru.com. Harney and Sons Fine Teas, holiday gifts of loose teas to sachets and cookies, treats, teapots, teaware, and other gift ideas in Millerton and Soho and online. Harney.com. And Albany Marriott, with 359 guest rooms, special event and meeting space with internet access, the Market Restaurant and Martini Lounge, and airport transportation. Facebook, Twitter, or AlbanyMarriott.com.
Midnight, 'neath a starry sky. Nice work if you can get it, and you can get it if you try. Strolling with one girl, sigh and sigh after sigh. Nice work if you can get it, and you can get it if you try. Just imagine someone waiting at the cottage door, where two hearts become one. Who could ask anything more? Loving one who loves you, and then taking that vow. Nice work if you can get it, and if you get it, won't you tell me how?
Frank Sinatra on the centennial, which will officially be tomorrow. Frank Sinatra was born 100 years ago tomorrow, and we'll be celebrating the centennial later on in the program. We continue the roundtable panel this morning with some other issues. I do want to get to this because it's a big story, not only throughout the nation, but also in our region, which is the Connecticut gun ban. This was with the mass shooting, of course, in California last week, focusing attention on terrorism and guns. Governor Daniel Malloy of Connecticut announced on Thursday that he intended to sign an executive order barring people on federal terrorism watch lists from buying firearms in the state. He says, like all Americans, I've been horrified by the recent terrorist attacks in San Bernardino and Paris. Mr. Malloy, a Democrat, told reporters, this should be a wake-up call to all of us. This is a moment to seize in America. And today I'm here to say that we in Connecticut are indeed seizing it. And, of course, Connecticut, who has had its share of horrific gun violence, very quick to act in this particular case. Alan.
Well, you know, Connecticut is a little tiny state in a big 50-state map. We all know that the problem is that people can get guns anywhere and bring them anywhere else, but it's courageous. But I think there's an interesting aspect to this, and that is the Supreme Court recently ruled in, I thought, an unexpected fashion that that a locality putting a hold on the ability to own large guns and ammunition was they refused to hear the case. And so they let it, if I read that correctly, they let it go forward, meaning that the law stood in a specific place. Now, if Malloy is doing what he's supposed to, is what he's doing here, he may be setting up a precedent for everybody else to be doing the same thing. And I think I smell that the court, as bad as it is, and it's a bad court run by five bad people, I think that the court is beginning to reexamine the lunacy of allowing unrestricted gun stuff in the states.
Well, I wish I were as hopeful as that. I think it's it was a nice gesture, particularly in a state that suffered one of the most horrible mass shootings in recent time, the school. But you can drive a half an hour out of Connecticut and be in a state where you can buy a gun, and real measures to do something that will protect us have to be taken at the federal level, I think. So it doesn't mean very much. It's kind of the futility of doing something at the state level on this matter.
It may not mean anything practically, but the thing is, it is drawing a line in the sand, and it also, as people have already said, it's an example for others to look at to see, okay, somebody is stepping up and saying, why don't we connect these particular dots?
Well, that's true, and Andrew Cuomo did the same thing with the SAFE Act, and that has not been emulated, so I'm not hopeful.
That was at a somewhat different historical period than now.
Well, it was right after Sandy Hook. So it was indeed in the same period where we're seeing not just mass shootings, but mass shootings with regularity. Mm-hmm. So,
But don't you guys think that sometimes things have to get really, I hate this, but have to get really, really bad before even like those five conservative judges on the Supreme Court say, hey, you know, this, we're going to go down on the wrong side of history on this one.
When you have more mass shootings than there are days in the year.
Right.
That have elapsed. Well, I guess you could have twice as many. As
would that be the point when you're shooting first graders in their schoolrooms? Haven't we reached that low point?
I agree with you. And what? And the other question, following on what Barbara just said, is, you know, waiting for what? I mean, there comes a point where we just really have to say, okay, this is it now. And I think those guys up on that court with grandchildren and nieces and nephews and children have an understanding of what has gone wrong in this country.
Let's talk about San Bernardino for a moment as we wrap up, and that is that the San Bernardino shooter used a friend to dodge gun check and may have planned a larger attack, according to sources. Saeed Farouk, one of the shooters in last week's massacre at a San Bernardino Social Services Center, asked a friend to buy two rifles used in the attack so he could dodge a federal background check. So this gets into what we were just talking about, and also may have been planning an even larger assault, according to government sources familiar with the ever-widening investigation.
Yeah, I hope we see charges against this neighbor. I mean, I said to my mother today, Mom, if I said, go buy me two assault rifles, I don't want to have to go through the background check, would you do it for me? I mean, she knows me, and she wouldn't do it. Mm-hmm. So why would a neighbor do that if he were not part of the effort or sympathized with it?
It's
unbelievable.
Really completely bizarre.
Carry this package onto the plane for me, would you please? I don't want to have to go through customs.
Do you think that when they talk about these other attacks, do you think it was like subsequent to what they did? Or how were they imagining this? Was it something earlier that they decided not to do? Or was it we're going to survive this?
I don't know. I mean, the earlier wisdom was that it was a larger attack that was being planned, and that there was something that triggered this to be the moment that they were going to go and seem to be a little hasty. But I don't know.
Right.
And I don't think officials, if they do know, they're not saying.
They're
not released the information. Alan, did you want to weigh in?
No.
Okay.
2 pounds.
Okay, 2 pounds. Why don't you leave us with some letters then?
Okay, will do. As soon as I can organize.
Well, things. I have to say something about Frank Sinatra in the meantime.
Oh, yes.
Me too.
Go Frank.
Me too.
Total fan. I was raised on Frank Sinatra, along with Ella Fitzgerald and Count Basie, etc. And the thing is that I really like him. Well, yeah, I like him very much because of his talent. I try not to think about who he was.
and the mafia and the rest of it.
Except
right.
for the fact that he was speaking out against racism and demonstrating
right.
anti-racism at a time that virtually no other white person did. You look at Bing Crosby and some of those other people, it's like, oh, goodness, let me get as far away as possible. So, you know, I'm just going to say this, and some people will get it. For Frank Sinatra, I whistle and stamp.
There you go.
We're getting a lot of different letters on Frank, and I think that Barbara has set up the debate quite nicely. I mean, you know, we all know who the singer in the Godfather was supposed to be. So, you know, and the horse's head and the job and all the rest of it. And then the pictures of him and Sam Giancana and the rest. There were some things that were not so pleasant about Sinatra. But I agree with Barbara. I really get tearful when I hear the guy's voice. I just think it's a time. It's a nostalgia. And he was a wonderful singer.
And for an opposing point of view, we go to Rosemary Armeo.
No. I can't talk about it. I don't appreciate him. My sister and my mother adore him, so I heard lots of them, too. But his songs all sound like 40s. They all sound the same to me. They're silly lyrics and hopelessly romantic when you know it's real life. I just can't. I just
it's
don't
the great
go
American
with.
Songbook.
Exactly.
It's the greatest songs
Thank
ever
you, Joe.
Written.
Thank
I know.
Joe.
I can't talk about this because I know it's not a popular view. I just don't get it. I listen
What's wrong
to
the with
Beatles.
The 40s?
And you know what it is? It's a difference, like between what you're talking about. Like some people love musicals. I'm raising my hand.
I like those. I like
oh, you like musicals,
and I love opera.
That's interesting.
I know. I'm getting. Oh, Ray Graff is here looking at me. He won't
him
think
in.
About me the same.
Open
anymore.
The door. Open the door.
Along with you, Rose.
I know. It's a deep. And they all talk about his enunciation and his timing.
Oh my God.
And
oh yes.
It's like,
did you hate
I don't
Elvis?
Get it.
You hated Elvis too.
I love Elvis.
Okay. All right.
Elvis, not even in the same universe.
I liked Perry Como. Perry Como was incredibly handsome, which Frank Sinatra was not, skinny little guy. And he was had a beautiful voice, and he reminded me of my father, Perry Como.
But he was not the level of singer that,
so I'm
objectively,
told.
Objectively.
So I'm told, yes. Barbara, I understand.
I like Perry Como, too. But the thing is, that's not the same.
Yeah, maybe not to that level. Right, to that level.
And Rick Orlando says the singer in The Godfather was a portrayal of Al Martino.
I've heard that. But most people thought it was Frank Sinatra.
He was well-loved. Frank Sinatra was well-loved also by other practitioners of jazz. Who
right,
were primarily
right.
Oh, absolutely.
Jazz.
And the thing is, that's fascinating because he was, you know, he was like in the club.
Yeah.
He could swing.
Yeah. I should mention I also don't appreciate jazz. So I think
oh,
that's
good
part
grief.
Of it. I
Bye
know,
long, Jerry. So
I'm
long.
Defective. I know. Sorry.
And of course there was Ava Gardner, right? Was
oh.
it yeah, that
Well, that was the sad, yes.
The love of his life.
Sad, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Not Mia Farrow, huh?
That was later.
And Nancy Ordman says, I agree with Rosemary about Sinatra and Perry Como.
Well, at least we got that right. All right. We are out of time. I want to thank everybody for being with us this morning. Of course, to our panel, Alan, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
Enjoy your time in your undisclosed location, and we will see you at your disclosed location on Monday.
Great.
Rosemary, have a wonderful Sinatra-free weekend.
See you Monday.
And Barbara, have a wonderful Sinatra-filled weekend.
Thank you.
Excellent.
So much. Thank you.
Speaking of Sinatra, we'll start our Sinatra centennial celebration after this.